I saw in an interview you did a while back that as an undergraduate, you kind of actively told yourself, I will not go into law. You were not interested in law.
True. And probably that's because I went to college. I'm actually the first person in my family to earn a college degree. I applied to one school, which was Gonzaga, and I applied there because they had a debate team. And I then got a debate scholarship. And you hang around with debaters enough and you realize there are other things besides law, which it seemed like most debaters were going into. So maybe just my contrarian streak, I didn't think that would be a direction I'd be interested in.
What changed your mind?
You know, I started a PhD program in philosophy, and I think like many motivated undergrads, I loved the academic part of school. I thought I would love to be a professor. And then two things happened. The first is I experienced, you know, my first full dose of sexism when I started the PhD program, and the message was, well, you know, you might be a good community college professor, but women don't really get to do phenomenology and the things I was interested in. But the second thing is more of my friends had started law school, and they said, this is the greatest experience of my life. I love it. You would love it. And, you know, I started realizing I'm a practical person, and more than philosophy, I'm interested in how we organize ourselves as human beings in a society, and that's what law is all about.
There's a quote from your swearing-in as Supreme Court Justice from 2008 that I want to get your reaction to, because I love this quote. You said, the courts are the one place where the smallest dog can lift his leg against the biggest tree.
Yeah, totally true. I think from an access to justice perspective, that is so true of courts. You know, this is the place where everyone comes to the court to resolve their disputes, and we treat people fairly and equally. It doesn't matter what position you hold in society, you have the same status as a litigant in the court. Now, obviously, there are practical impediments to access to justice, and we're working hard to try to even the playing field in reality. But the notion remains, and I think it guides most judges, that everyone who comes in front of the court is equal. And so that quote is not original to me. That's from a cowboy poet I've always loved. And I just think that's such a great description.
How do you bring the practical in line with the theoretical? The law says in theory we're all equal. How do you as a judge make sure that that's true?
In some ways, judges can only do so much to make sure that's true. You know, our lane is maintaining the rule of law and maintaining systems that are consistent. I mean, another of my favorite quotes that comes from literature, from A Man for All Seasons, the story of Sir Thomas More, is when he has a son-in-law who's really a firebrand and wants to change every law that needs to be changed in order to achieve justice. And Thomas More says, well, if you start cutting down those trees that are the laws that provide the rule of law, then where are you going to hide from the winds that'll blow if those trees aren't there? And so I think as judges, we have to be aware that our role is to foster, develop, and preserve the rule of law as it applies in contemporary society, because it is a more complex society. We can't solve all the problems that lead to social strife and inequality, but we can do our best to make sure that when people come to court, they are heard and the cases are decided based on the rule of law.
Is the law profession getting better for women?
I do think that as more women come into the profession and overcome any number of barriers, it's better for all of the women who follow. I mean, I certainly benefited from those who came before me. I think some of the biggest challenges in the law profession are to families, to women who are mothers, to men who are fathers, because trying to find the work-life balance remains difficult. And that's not unique to law, but I think the legal profession is one of those where, you know, exhaustion is a status symbol, and you're only as good as what you've done lately. And so some of that, finding that balance, is difficult. But I think in terms of the number of women who are remaining in the profession and achieving leadership positions, it's getting stronger and stronger every year, though it has lagged behind where probably all of us thought it would be 20 years ago. You know, when you looked at the number of women who were coming into law school, probably 50% in my class, and then you look at the number of women who remain in the profession and who move up the ranks, and it's nowhere near 50, 40, even 30%.
May I ask you about being a first-generation college student?
Mm-hmm.
How did that shape you?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So my dad's a first-generation American. My mom grew up desperately poor and was an orphan at the age of 14, so she wasn't even able to finish high school. She had to go support herself and some younger siblings. And so for them, the emphasis they put on education for, you know, their daughters, I have four sisters, was to encourage us to find our way. There was never any sense of you can't do that because you're a girl. Good Lord. I mean, of course, you know, they have five girls. there's nowhere to hide. So, and I have to say, Gonzaga changed my life and my whole family's life. All along, I received encouragement that said, you can do this. You know, there have to be mentors there who just pick you up and see the raw talent.
Do you have opportunities to interact with first-generation college students?
All the time. Yeah. From well before I became a justice, I've been involved in Upward Bound and in mentorship programs, and I just think one of the most important things all of us should be doing, starting with kids at a young age, is lifting them up, encouraging them about the talent they have. I remember seeing research years ago through an Upward Bound training that a common feature among people who achieve higher education and, you know, launch their career is that seven adults other than a parent had some impact on their life, whether it's a coach or a music teacher or a volunteer. And so I think that's a responsibility I owe. But it's also just a great joy. You know, there's just so many talented people who need to see themselves as the next Chief Justice.
What does being Chief Justice mean to you?
To me, it really is an opportunity to help guide and organize and do the work of the court in a new way. The role of the Chief Justice in our system is administrative mainly. It's a heavy load of just helping keep all of the projects in the branch moving, and that is very exciting to me, getting to work more closely with lower court judges, with the administrative office of the court that helps provide service to all of those other courts, and really move the programs of the court forward. Internally, it also means helping create an atmosphere here where I support my fellow justices so that we work collegially on the projects we do together, but also that they get to go out and do the projects, all the good work they're doing for the administration of justice.
It seems like such an interesting role to be on the Supreme Court especially, because on one hand you are the face of an institution and you're public figures in that way, that you're representing the rule of law and the fairness of law, but you're also individuals who come from different backgrounds. You're the only justice from Eastern Washington.
Yeah, currently.
Currently.
So it is true that I think anyone who comes to wear a robe brings who they are and what their experiences are with them. That doesn't mean those experiences or individual personality drives their decisions. It doesn't mean that at all. But I do think diverse justices better inform a more complete sense of justice. And we have the most diverse court right now in the history of the Washington State Supreme Court. And geographic diversity is one measure of that because, as you know, this is a very diverse state. People have very different experiences.
When you are the Chief Justice, who do you look to for guidance? I'm always curious, people at the top of their field, you know, from whom do you seek mentorship?
Well, that's an easy question because I seek it from my colleagues. You know, to be the Chief Justice is to be, you know, first among equals and truly equals. We try to speak as one voice when possible. We debate. At the end of the day, we take a vote on a lot of matters, and you stand up for the result of that vote. So I'm finding, you know, tremendous wisdom I gain from those who have served in the Chief Justice role and those who've served on the court a long time, but also from, you know, the colleagues who are junior to me, and what they bring to the court is tremendous. So that's really where I turn. You don't look up, you look in, because we really all work so collaboratively as a body of nine.
I want to ask you a little bit about how this court works. By the time you hear a case, what has it generally been through? I'm sure they're all different.
The mainstay of our jurisdiction is cases that come up from the lower courts. So in a typical case, there has been a trial. Somebody wins, somebody loses. The loser has a constitutional right to appeal. And they appeal most of the time to the Intermediate Court of Appeals. And as you know, we have three divisions of that court, which are geographically distributed. And then that's the end of their constitutional right to appeal. And our jurisdiction is discretionary. So people can petition for review in this court. We have published criteria that govern what we're looking for in a case. You know, is there a conflict among the lower courts? Is it a significant public issue? Is it an issue of constitutional magnitude? So when we make those decisions, we do divide the court into two panels, conveniently called Panel 1 and Panel 2. And the Chief Justice sits on both panels so that there are five on each. It takes five votes to either accept or reject a case. So if we do not agree at department, then the case is set over for the next en banc, and the whole group of nine decides whether to take the case, still requiring five votes to take or to deny. I should mention there's a narrow class of cases that are required to come straight to us. When the death penalty was actively being sought, death penalty appeals and a proportionality review come directly to the Supreme Court, and some other cases by constitution come straight to us.
One of the things I learned about the court that surprised me, you know, we are used to as the public waiting a while before a case is decided, mm-hmm. Before the opinion comes out. But I was surprised to learn that the justices decide the case the very day the arguments are heard, and what takes the time is the writing of the opinion.
I'd slightly correct that.
Please.
The justices do not decide the case until the signatures are on the paper.
Okay.
So we do take a vote on the day of argument. So immediately after we hear oral argument, we convene as a group, and that will be the first time that we have formally debated the case. And even that presentation has some rigor and formality. But
that's interesting, because we're used to like a jury room idea where, mm-hmm. where the jurors go into the room and, you know, if the movies are to be believed, all yell at each other until they come to a conclusion.
Yeah.
But this is very orderly over extreme matters of law.
I mean. Absolutely. A jury may be together for one case. We're together all the time. So you have to learn to disagree without being disagreeable, and to have constructive, principled debate. And that is really what we strive for. Oftentimes, the opinion that comes out in the end is so much stronger because of the disagreements that happen during the course of writing.
Can I ask you, you talk about disagreeing without being disagreeable. Do you ever step out of the temple of justice and go into the world to grocery shop or drive yourself home or whatever and think, gosh, I wish that was the rule everywhere?
Oh, I do. You know, I think that in every phase of all of our lives, we're in a moment where the tenor of debate can be pretty nasty, and the lines can be so sharply drawn. And, you know, it's hard to live your life in a world where it's, you know, us and them, or this side or that side. And I think what being in the law teaches anyone, but especially being on a collegial court such as this one, is you have to be able to hold an idea without necessarily embracing it, to see both sides of an argument, to try to come to a reasoned position that you believe best reflects you know, the outcome that is consistent with the law and with justice. And if that's done in a respectful way, everybody is better for that. I hope for, you know, I try to practice in my own interactions, and what I hope for our discourse in the public is that we try to celebrate that more than we do trying to stake out our turf and divide the world into this and that.
I think the law can seem to people like the system and this impenetrable thing that just looms over all of us. But you step into a courtroom, at least my experience as a reporter has been, you step into a courtroom and it feels like a very human place. How do you find the humanity in the law?
Oh, I think the law is about humanity. It's stories. It's people's real lives. And, you know, it may be one case of a dozen that a judge is going to hear in a day, but it may be the most important thing in the lives of the litigants in that case. So I think if you don't see the humanity in it, you're missing the whole point. But I think what judges can also bring to it is a healthy perspective and a sense of the long view. And, you know, at the end of the day, the preservation of the rule of law in the context of that case is what we strive to maintain.
You have said a law degree is a license to change the world in a variety of ways. So how do you hope this court changes the world?
I think this court, as I mentioned, it's the most diverse court in the history of Washington. We richly debate issues because we bring different perspectives. And I think the way we will change the view of the law is that it will become more personal and more real to so many people because they will see it through the eyes of people who don't take it for granted, you know, who have these different perspectives. And so I think, though each of us who serves on this court may have entered the practice of law with a different dream or a different goal, well, now we have, you know, the same goal, which is, you know, to make access to justice a reality for everyone in the state, to try to write decisions that are clear. And I think we're setting a tone for healthy discourse that will be a proud legacy of this court.
Chief Justice Deborah Stevens, thank you for your time.
Thank you.